I'm Wally, and I am an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Sunday morning session of AA, the greatest spiritual movement of the 20th century. Did want to open by explaining the frantic activity just a few minutes ago upon my arrival. I went out to the Weston Priory this morning for the service that's held at 5 a.m. And it's a very, very spiritual place. I do know that several of you are going out there this afternoon. This morning, I just happened to be there when one of the brothers did a reading. Normally they do a lot of singing and Bible reading, but this was a non-biblical reading that he did, and it was basically addiction and grace. And talk about nothing happening by accident. I just knew I had to be there this morning, and I certainly needed to hear this message in terms of how self-will cannot relieve us of these various afflictions and addictions that we all are subject to, but only by the grace of God can we recover. And right now, I was in the process. Oh, let me explain a little bit further. After the service was over, the lay brothers go into cloister, which is, they cannot talk. And I could not fathom how I could get to these people. But as everybody was leaving the service, going out the back door, two people went through a front door. And I followed them actually into the inner sanctum of the Western Priory. Got lost, turned around, and these two people found me. And I explained who I was and that I was on this mission from God to try to obtain this this peace, this addiction and grace peace from Brother Robert, who read it this morning. And he explained that it would take a while because of them not being able to speak to come up with it. As fate would have it, he said that the brothers would be getting out at 8 o'clock, and he'd be able to approach them then. Well, that did not happen, but in the meantime, I was quite tired and was looking for a shelter in the from the storm, so to speak, and drove just a few miles to Peter L's cabin, the archivist here for the Wilson House, and the light was on and smoke was going up the chimney, and he was still in his pajamas, but he welcomed me with open arms, and he let me sleep there for an hour and a half. I went back and still was not able to obtain the peace, but Mitchell Kay is in the process of working on that, and if we can possibly have that before the conclusion, we'll read that to you. If not, we will certainly be making copies of it and sending it out to each and every person that was here, because I'll tell you, it's one of the most powerful, powerful pieces I've ever heard in terms of living in the solution. So I was not able to obtain it on the first pass, but we're working on Plan B right now. Okay, let's get on with AA in the 1940s and why it worked. I'm going to start with the concept of prayer and meditation, and which I consider to be the most important part of this program. This prayer and meditation, for the most part, began at Dr. Bob's house in 1935. Bill Wilson had moved in for the summer, spent the summer with Dr. Bob and Ann. And while he was there, he learned quite a bit from Ann Smith, primarily, on prayer and meditation. Many AAs believe that Dr. Bob's wife, Ann, was instrumental in convincing Bill of the necessity of a quiet time as part of the AA program. She directed the spiritual program that was practiced during the summer of 1935, and her program consisted of prayer, Bible study, quiet time, spiritual discussions, and meetings. Bill did incorporate the quiet time concept into the 11th step, when he suggested that AA seek God through prayer and meditation. In a letter written to Bill W. by Henrietta D., the wife of Bill D., AA number 3, she commented on Ann Smith's spiritual program. And this is a quote from her letter. "Ann taught me to have a quiet time in the morning that I may feel near to God and receive strength for the day." So we have quite a bit to thank Ann Smith a debt in terms of the spiritual aspects of the program. I want to first of all read from the big book what Bill actually wrote about this in Step 11. What I think is uncanny, it says, "Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. We shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. It should be easy. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions." Well, that's what I've found in my travels, and probably one of the vaguest parts of this book, even though Bill tried to be clear and concise and said it would be easy to be vague about this matter, and he wanted to make definite and valuable suggestions. A couple things that he didn't want to do was divulge the source material for this section, which is what is the Oxford Group. That's where this prayer and meditation, starting on page 86, came from. I'm going to actually read the source material, but I do want to read what Bill had to say. "On awakening, we let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration, an intuitive thought, or a decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We are often surprised how the right answers come after we have tried this for a while. What used to be a hunch or an occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Still being inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it is not probable that we are going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely upon it." The key words that Bill was trying to avoid using, the words quiet time and guidance. And by not using those words, I have found talking to many people around the country that those two paragraphs are not clear and concise. But this is what was actually written in What is the Oxford Group? This is the chapter titled Guidance. And I'm going to start on page 67 and see how much of this has a familiar ring to it based upon what I just read out of the big book. "The Oxford Group realized that guidance is not anyone's particular property. It is as free to all of us as are the sun and air, and that there is no reason why everyone, whatever his status or Christian creed, cannot come out of the darkness and breathe the clear and spiritual health-giving properties of God's radiant counsel. Divine guidance takes away from us that fear of tomorrow, which in conjunction with the troubles of today so often make life intolerable for us. Not only is our today in God's keeping, but our tomorrow. We have surrendered that to Him. So why fear whatever we think tomorrow must bring us as a logical consequence of today's events? Fear of the future, whether it be of tomorrow or old age, means that we do not trust in God's guidance. Our faith in the future is the infallible test of our faith in Him. and this is getting right to the heart of what Bill used, a quiet time with the Holy Spirit every morning before the daily toil and common round of the world commences will put us in the right key for the day. These early morning quiet times in which God impresses on our minds His counsel become living spots in the routine of ordinary life. The Oxford Group advocates our use of pencil and notebook so that we may record every God-given thought and idea that comes to us during our time alone with Him, that no detail, however small, may be lost to us, and that we may not shirk the truth about ourselves or any problem when it comes to us. I find that interesting that the suggestion in terms of writing is to write down God's guidance in step 11. What I have found in my travels is more and more people emphasizing writing as part of step 4. And there are some people that advocate going back and doing inventory after inventory after inventory and just continuing to journal as part of step 4. Well, step 4 is when we're still living in the problem. And based upon what I see here, what we need to be thinking about, if we are going to write, is to be writing as part of step 11, when we're in the solution. And this is the proper use of the pen and pencil, according to the Oxford Group. And I have found it very valuable in my life personally. The author goes on to say, it is not suggested that everything we write down during our quiet times necessarily comes from God. Bill lifted that almost directly. The human mind, being what it is, wanders from concentration at an outside interruption, takes up the train of thought it finds hard to discard, invents or remembers a thought of its own. But to those closely in touch with God, it becomes easy after a short while to differentiate between spiritual and human messages. See, that's, again, the reason for writing this down, is because everything that we write is not necessarily from God, and we need to be able to distinguish God's will from self-will. In cases of difficulty, our guidance can be checked with the teachings of the Bible or by conferences with others who are also receiving guidance in quiet times. That's why, again, we need to write what our guidance is so that we can discuss that with another human being. Again, somebody who is also following the guidance of God in their quiet times. I found it very difficult to find anybody in AA that had those qualifications. My spiritual advisor and sponsor now does this, and I'm able to share with him, but it took me actually several years to find somebody in AA that was actually receiving guidance. The other part of this that I found quite interesting is on page 72, self-will is the hardest thing in existence to surrender to God. The majority of us will surrender just enough of ourselves to Him so that we can keep what we think is our independence. It is that little piece of self-will we keep, even though we think it is so secret and hidden that God Himself will not notice it, which prevents us from receiving the infinite and complete benefits and grace of guidance. This is where steps 6 and 7 are so important in terms of first of all, learning what our character defects are, and then asking God to remove them. And here it doesn't say just being willing to remove them. It says that they have to be removed in order for God's guidance to shine through. It says here we must give our entirety to God in our quiet times with Him and when we are carrying His guidance out. what seems at first as difficult as is giving one's entire thoughts and concentration to God in prayer. But discipline over self-will, although it may be slow, comes with practice. Bill further on says we are undisciplined and we let God discipline us. This is again quite similar from the Oxford group when they say, this seems at first as difficult as is giving one's entire thoughts and concentration to God in prayer, but discipline over our self-will, although it may be slow, comes with practice, and practice and regularity are as necessary to learning to make the best use of guidance as they are in learning anything that is worth learning in this world. As a part of the 4 one-hour classes that I teach, I have found it necessary. It's the only time I deviate from taking everything out of the big book because those pages do seem to be so unclear, is that I do provide the big book passages as well as the source material. Another part of the prayer and meditation that has just come to us, thanks to Jim Houck, is this piece that I just saw for the first time last week. I consider it to be an absolutely essential piece in terms of the mechanics of the 11th step. And this is in your packets. It's How to Listen to God. And I do want to get this on tape for those that aren't here and don't have the packets. These are a few simple suggestions for people who are willing to make an experiment. You can discover for yourself the most important and practical thing any human being can ever learn: how to be in touch with God. All that is needed is the willingness to try it honestly. Every person who has done this consistently and sincerely has found that it really works. And I can personally attest to it. Before you begin, look over these fundamental points. They are true and are based on the experience of thousands of people. 1. God is alive. He always has been and He always will be. 2. God knows everything. 3. God can do anything. 4. God can be everywhere, all at the same time. 5. God is invisible. We can't see Him or touch Him, but God is here. He is with us now. He is beside us. He surrounds us. He fills the room or the whole place where we are right now. He is with us now. He is in our hearts. 6. God cares very much for us. He is interested in us. He has a plan for our lives. He has an answer for every need and problem we may face. 7. God will tell us all we need to know. He will not always tell us all that we want to know. 8. God will help you do anything that He asks us to do. 9. Anyone can be in touch with God anywhere and at any time if these conditions are obeyed. Just as Brother Lawrence back in 1666 taught us about practicing the presence of God. He is with us and we can be in touch with Him at any time. And these are the conditions: to be quiet and still, to listen, to be honest about every thought that comes, to test the thoughts to be sure that they come from God, and to obey. So with these basic elements as a background, here are specific suggestions on how to listen to God. 1. Take time. Find some place and time where you can be alone, quiet, and undisturbed. Most people have found that the early morning is the best time. Have with you some paper and pen or pencil. 2. Relax. Sit in a comfortable position. Consciously relax all your muscles. Be loose. There is no hurry. There needs to be no strain during these minutes. God cannot get through to us if we are tense and anguished and anxious about later responsibilities. 3. Tune in. Open your heart to God. Either silently or loud, Just say to God in a natural way that you would like to find His plan for your life. You want His answer to the problem or situation that you are facing just now. Be definite and specific in your request. 4, listen. Just be still, quiet, relaxed, and open. Let your mind go loose. Let God do the talking. Thoughts, ideas, and impressions will begin to come into your mind and heart. Be alert and aware and open to everyone. 5, write. Here is the important key to the whole process. Write down everything that comes into your mind. Everything. Writing is simply a means of recording so that you can remember later. Don't sort out or edit your thoughts at this point. Write down everything. Good thoughts, bad thoughts, comfortable thoughts, uncomfortable thoughts, holy thoughts, unholy thoughts, sensible thoughts, crazy thoughts. Be honest. Write down everything. A thought comes quickly and it escapes even more quickly unless it is captured and put down. 6, test. When the flow of thoughts slows down, stop. Take a good look at what you have written. Not every thought we have comes from God, so we need to test our thoughts. Here is where the written record helps us to be able to look at them. A. Are they completely honest, pure, loving, and selfish? B. Are they in line with our real duties to our family, to our country? C. Are they in line with my understanding of the teachings of the Bible? 7. Check. When in doubt and when it is important, what does another person who is living two-way prayer think about this thought or action? More light comes in through two windows than one. Someone else who also wants God's plan for our lives may help us to see more clearly. Talk over together what you have written. Many people do this. They tell each other what guidance has come. This is the secret of unity. There are always three sides to every question: your side, my side, and the right side. Guidance shows us which is the right side, not who is right, but what is right. 8, obey. Carry out the thoughts that have come. You will only be sure of guidance as you go through with it. A rudder will not guide a boat unless the boat is moving. So you obey. Very often the results will convince you that you are on the right track. 9, blocks. What if I don't seem to get any definite thoughts? God's guidance is as freely available as the air we breathe. If I am not receiving thoughts when I listen, the fault is not God's. Usually it's because there is something I will not do. Something wrong in my life that I will not face and make right. A habit or indulgence I will not give up. A person I will not forgive. A wrong relationship in my life I will not give up. A restitution I will not make. Something God has already told me to do that I will not obey. Ooh, I got one of those myself right now to deal with. That was interesting. Check these points and be honest. It was honest. And try listening again. 10, mistakes. Suppose I make a mistake and do something in the name of God that isn't right. Of course we make mistakes. We're all humans with many faults. However, God will always honor our sincerity. He will work around and through every honest mistake we make. He will help us make it right. But remember this, sometimes when we do obey God, someone else may not like it or agree with it. So when there is opposition, it doesn't always mean you have made a mistake. It can mean that the other person doesn't want to know or to do what is right. I just want to make a comment on that. Father John Doe, or Father Ralph Fowle, one of the first Catholic priests in AA in the 1940s, wrote a series of golden books and several other works that a lot of early AAs read. And Father Pfau was one of our Phoenix snowbirds, and he would come down to Phoenix, Arizona, and spend the winters and share at a lot of meetings in the area. And one of the things that was passed on to me was a statement that Father Pfau made from the podium. And this is in the mid-40s, so some things have never changed in AA. And he said, if you want to be criticized in AA, do something. Anything. So even though there's some opposition, remember that if you are being guided, part of that guidance is to obey the guidance and follow through in spite of the opposition, because in AA there always will be opposition no matter what you do. And continuing on, suppose I fail to do something that I have been told and the opportunity to do it passes. There is only one thing to do. Put it right with God. Tell him you're sorry. Ask him to forgive you, then accept his forgiveness and begin again. God is our Father. He is not an impersonal computer. He understands us far better than we do. And the results? We never know what swimming is like until we get into the water and try it. We will never know what guidance is like unless we sincerely try it. Every person who has tried guidance honestly finds that a wisdom not their own comes into their minds, and that a power greater than human beings operates in their lives. It is an endless adventure. There is a way of life for everyone, everywhere. Anyone can be in touch with the living God anywhere, anytime, if we fulfill his conditions. When man listens, God speaks. When man obeys, God acts. This is the law of prayer. God's plan for this world goes forward through the lives of ordinary people who are willing to be governed by him. And I can't think of a more definitive sets of suggested guidelines on how to make that conscious contact. Of course, in AA, the old-timers and pioneers have always been trying to make this conscious contact. It was an integral part of the program. And part of that was through morning devotionals. Dr. Bob required of his sponsees that they read the Upper Room or some other daily devotional as a way of getting ready for the guidance, getting ready for the quiet time. It's interesting that the Upper Room, the first issue of the Upper Room, this is a copy of it, is May, June, and July. No, I'm sorry, April, May, June of 1935. When Dr. Bob came out of the fog and had his last drink, the first issue of the Upper Room is what was sitting on the table. So they seem to have gone hand in hand in Dr. Bob's life. The Upper Room is still available. It's still in publication. The AAs also used other devotionals. This one, My Utmost for His Highest, was written by Oswald Chambers, a member of the Oxford Group. This is one of the Oxford Group devotionals. Jim read from a devotional yesterday that I had not seen before. So there are many of them out there. And then another member of the Oxford Group wrote two additional daily meditations, God Calling and God at Even Time. God Calling in 1945, God at Evening Time in 1955. So again, these were being read by our early AAs. And then God Calling was taken by a gentleman by the name of Richmond Walker and modified from the Oxford Group 2AA. It was published as the 24 Hours a Day book. Now, Richmond Walker put this together in 1951 for AA, and he offered it to the General Service Conference in 1951, and they talked about it and voted on it in 1952, and they voted not to accept it. The book was then offered to Hazelton, and Hazelton started publishing it in 1952 and has been publishing it ever since. And this is now a book that is second only to the Big Book in terms of its use within AA. When we say that there's been in excess of 15 million copies of the Big Book sold to date, there have been in excess of 7 million copies of 24 Hours a Day. I think AAs have been crying out for a meditation book ever since that incident in 51, 52. It only took the World Service Organization 40 years, but starting in 1990, they started publishing daily reflections for us. So now we have a meditation book by AA members, for AA members, from the AA World Service. So there are plenty of meditation guides out there for our use, and I consider them to be an integral part of my morning meditation. It gets me centered so that I can get into the quiet time and listen for God's guidance. So that's how they were doing it back in the early days in terms of the prayer and meditation. I'm going to move now into the early AA literature and start with four Akron pamphlets that were written starting in the early 40s. I do have copies of them here if anybody wants to personally go through them. Mitchell, as part of his archival display, has the originals if you want to see what the originals look like. These four pamphlets were titled A Manual for Alcoholics Anonymous, A Guide to the 12 Steps, Spiritual Milestones in AA, and The Second Reader in AA. These pamphlets were written by Evan Williams at the direction of Dr. Bob. Evan had been an editor of the Akron Beacon Journal, but had been fired because of his alcoholism. After getting sober, he was rehired at an entry-level position as a clerk. He got sober in May of 1941. Once Evan was on his feet, Dr. Bob asked him to write some quote-unquote, blue-collar AA pamphlets. That's just how Dr. Bob put it. As Dr. Bob explained, the Big Book was too complicated for many AAs, and he wanted Evan to present the program in its most basic terms. Here we go back to Dr. Bob's philosophy of keeping it simple. And the pamphlets were originally sold by the Akron Group and later sold by the Central Committee for Akron. A Manual for Alcoholics Anonymous, which we believe to be the first one published, has this on its cover. This pamphlet was written and edited by members of Alcoholics Anonymous in Akron, Ohio. It was in Akron that Alcoholics Anonymous was founded in 1935. Among Akron members are one of the founders, the first person to accept the program, and a large number of other members whose sobriety dates back to 1935, 1936, and 1937. And so those are the people that helped Dr. Bob in writing it, the early, early pioneers. The foreword to A Manual for Alcoholics Anonymous states, this booklet is intended to be a practical guide for new members and sponsors of new members to Alcoholics Anonymous. The pamphlet was written to give the newcomers a practical guideline for staying sober. First, the newcomer had to be willing to admit that he or she was an alcoholic. And this is a quote from the pamphlet. AA is not interested in sobering up drunks who are not sincere in their desire to remain completely sober for all times. It is not interested in alcoholics who want to sober up merely to go on another bender, sober up because of fear of their jobs, their wives, or social standing, or to clear up some trouble, either real or imaginary. In other words, if a person is genuinely sincere in his desire for continued sobriety for his own good, is convinced in his heart that alcohol holds him in its power, and is willing to admit that he is an alcoholic, members of Alcoholics Anonymous will do all in their power, spend days of their time to guide him to a new and happy and contented way of life. Next, the newcomer had to make a decision without reservation or procrastination. To the newcomer, this is your life. This is your choice. If you are not completely convinced to your own satisfaction that you are an alcoholic and your life has become unmanageable, if you are not ready to part with alcohol forever, it would be better for all concerned if you discontinue reading this and give up the idea of becoming a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the pamphlet also discusses the sponsor's responsibilities. And I even use the word sponsor in this pamphlet. You must assume full responsibility for this man. You must fulfill all pledges you make to him, either tangible or intangible. If you cannot fulfill a promise, do not make it. This is a very critical time in his life. He looks to you for courage, hope, comfort, and guidance. Accompany him to his first meeting. Take him along with you when you call on the next patient. Telephone him as often as possible. Urge him to look up the new friends he has made. Now, this appears to be almost 180 degrees out of sync with the way AA is practiced today. What I hear today, or see today, is people handing out their business cards and say, call me. If you want me to be your sponsor, call me. And that just, to me, doesn't make any sense, because we're supposed to be the ones who have recovered, and they're the ones that are still sick. How can we expect them to call us when they don't have a clue as to what this is all about? And as this pamphlet says, we should be calling them on a regular basis, even daily. As soon as the newcomer was out of the hospital, he was given the following plan of action. Okay, first off, your day will have a new pattern. You will open the day. These aren't suggestions here. You will open the day with a quiet time. This will be explained by your sponsor. You see, since all of this is lost, there's no sponsors to even explain to the newcomer how to start their day. You will read the upper room, or whatever you think best for yourself. You will say a little prayer asking for help during the day. Your sponsor may drop in to see you or call you on the telephone. So he's even telling the sponsee, the newcomer, that to expect a phone call. There will be a meeting of an AA group. Attend it without question. Of course, these were just one meeting a week groups, and only one group per city, so it was just a once a week meeting. You may call on a new patient. Don't wait until tomorrow to do this. It doesn't say, don't wait until you've completed all the 12 steps. It doesn't say, wait until you've got 5 years of sobriety. It says, don't wait until tomorrow to do this. You will find the work fascinating. You will find a kindred soul, and you will be giving yourself a new boost along the road to sobriety. Finally, at the end of the day, you will say another little prayer of thanks and gratitude for a day of sobriety. You feel you have nothing to say to a new patient? No story to tell? Nonsense. And we're talking about somebody with maybe a week of sobriety here. This is who this is directed to. Nonsense. That's what it says. You've been sober for a day, or maybe even for a week. Obviously, you must have done something to stay sober, even for that short length of time. That is your story. With each succeeding visit, you will find that your story comes easier, and that you have more confidence in your ability to be of help. The harder you work at sobriety, the easier it is to maintain it. The early Akron AAs were well aware that receiving guidance during the morning quiet time was essential for spiritual growth, and working with other alcoholics was essentially for contented sobriety. And in the second pamphlet, which was titled A Guide to the 12 Steps, this pamphlet provided insight on the early AA beginners classes that I'll be talking about in a minute. And this is in the pamphlet, 1943-44. Most of the ideas and explanations were brought out in a series of instruction classes conducted by veteran members of the group. The pamphlet provided a simplified version of the steps. I found this interesting. Dr. Bob took the 12 steps and reduced them back to 4 in this pamphlet. It is important that the newcomer be introduced to the 12 steps at as early a date as possible. If you feel that the steps are a bit too complicated at first, you can introduce them to your newcomer in a simplified form, going into the complete program later. Anything to get them through the steps and into the solution, into the spiritual program of recovery. And these were the condensed form of the 12 steps. 1, we honestly admit we are powerless over alcohol and sincerely want to do something about it. 2, we ask to receive help from a power greater than ourselves and another human being. 3, we cleaned up our lives, paid our debts, righted wrongs. 4, we carried our new way of life to others desperately in need of it. So these were the steps taught to the newcomers while they were still in the fog, so that at least they could get into the solution, which is the restitution and working with others immediately. The third pamphlet in the series was titled Spiritual Milestones in Alcoholics Anonymous. This pamphlet describes the importance of spirituality and recovery and provides 7 suggestions, which were described as mileposts on the road to a spiritual life. And suggestion 7 was, seek the companionship of others who are seeking the spiritual life. In the discussion that followed, the AA church was described. In the early days, the kitchen was the church of Alcoholics Anonymous. A few members met almost every morning to have coffee together and pray together. So kitchens and coffee pots were our early churches. Then the author presented 3 case histories, much like the stories in the back of the big book, and he summarized the pamphlet. The ultimate aim of all men is peace of spirit. Without a spiritual life, there can be no tranquility and serenity. St. Augustine says, peace is the tranquility of order. We will find peace when our lives are rightly ordered. And the final section of the pamphlet contains the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi, which was the very first publication of this prayer within AA. And this pamphlet was produced many years before Bill wrote the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, in which he restates it in Step 11 on page 101. The fourth pamphlet, titled The Second Reader for Alcoholics Anonymous, I found interesting because it talked about those AAs who had been around for a while and for whom the initial glamour connected with AA was starting to wear off. And who is this pamphlet written to? People that have been around for several months, not years. So this was a re-injection of the spirituality. The author posed the question, what is there in AA beyond sobriety? He answered it in terms of establishing a balance between 4 aspects of our life. The journey towards balance does not mean neglecting AA or our 12-step work. Simply, as we grow older in the group, we learn to budget our time more efficiently. We are still doing the same amount of good for others and for ourselves, but it requires a fraction of the time we spent when we first found AA, the other factors that make up a normal life. This whole pamphlet was dedicated to returning us to the mainstream of society and making sure that we did not neglect our families or our work or any other responsibilities that we had to the community at large. And then there was a fifth pamphlet published, which I found to be, whoops, that's not the fifth pamphlet. Let's see if it's the next slide. There it is. We can come back to that later. What I found to be really quite profound about that is all of this information that I'm providing you so far is in the book that I wrote, But for the Grace of God, and it's in the Akron section. And I did put a picture of the four pamphlets and then the fifth pamphlet in the book. And I received a call from Sue Smith Windows, Dr. Bob's daughter, a couple months after the book had come out. And she asked specifically about this fifth pamphlet because it does have a lead that Dr. Bob made in, we think, 1943 in the book. And she said, "Would you please make me a copy of that pamphlet? I have never seen it." And I go, "What? You've never seen this pamphlet? I thought all five pamphlets came out as a set." And she said, "No. I have never seen that pamphlet, and I have never heard those words spoken by my dad before 1995. And then I called the Akron archivist, Gail L., and she had never seen the pamphlet or heard of it. And Ray G., the archivist for Dr. Bob's house, and he had never seen or heard of the pamphlet. And I uncannily and without any knowledge, ended up putting in the book a piece of AA history that had been lost from everywhere, from everyone in this fellowship. And so I do want to spend a little bit of time on that pamphlet. It's titled "What Others Think of Alcoholics Anonymous." It was it consisted of a series of reprints from various newspaper articles written in the early 1940s about Alcoholics Anonymous. The pamphlet was described in an article in the 1943 newsletter, the Cleveland Central Bulletin. A recently published booklet distributed by Akron's AAs has come to our attention and can be secured through your secretaries at the nominal cost of 10 cents. It is entitled "What Others Think of Alcoholics Anonymous" and contains editorials, news items, and articles published in newspapers in different parts of the country. It is well prepared and should be a great help in presenting AA's story to the skeptical prospect. So again, this was used as introductory literature for the newcomer, or literature that the 12-steppers carried with them when they went on their calls. Just going to read a couple of the sections. One was out of the Akron Beacon Journal on October of 1941. Anonymously they help. Sometimes drunks are jovial and hilarious. Sometimes they are depressed and morose. Whatever their state of mind, they would seem unlikely persons to enter wholeheartedly into a help one another movement, not a self-help movement. Right here in writing, early 1941, the definition of Alcoholics Anonymous, a help one another movement, especially if it has meant giving up alcohol completely. Yet that is exactly what has happened within the growing ranks of Alcoholics Anonymous within the last 5 years. One rummy has helped another, and in so doing has helped himself, until literally hundreds of lives have been reclaimed from the ravages of liquor. Again, that article goes on. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece. One that I'll be talking about later, in terms of our traditions and tradition breaks in the 1940s, is an article in the Akron Beacon Journal from July 42. AA Home Run. One of the things that makes baseball so intriguing is the way a man can be transformed from a hero to a bum overnight, or vice versa. But there's more than just that in the case of Raleigh Hemsley, fired by the Cincinnati Reds on Friday and the hero of the New York Yankees doubleheader on Sunday. Hemsley was once one of the best catchers and hardest drinkers in the American League. He would have been out of baseball long ago if it hadn't been for Alcoholics Anonymous, the organization which believes that the best way for a chronic alcoholic to cure himself is by helping others. And then the article goes on. If anybody would like, I don't have the entire pamphlet in the book, so I can make copies if somebody would like one. But I do want to read Dr. Bob's lead, which he made in Youngstown, Ohio, which I did not realize had been completely lost to the fellowship for all of these years. And this is what Dr. Bob had to say. Gratefully sober and about as cheerful as any group that ever gathered in Youngstown. Oh, this is the lead-in. This is the lead, I'm sorry. Gratefully sober and about as cheerful as any group that ever gathered in Youngstown, local members of Alcoholics Anonymous met Sunday night to hear one of their co-founders of the movement speak. In the room were nearly 100 well-dressed, clear-eyed, determined men who once were kings of the bottle and masters of building a hangover. The speaker told how he ended 35 years of steady drinking after trying various methods that included hospitals and sanitariums. Ardent reading of the Bible and an earnest desire to stay sober also failed. He still got drunk every night. Then he met the other founder-to-be, who had been sober for 4 months, and had learned that the way to convince himself was to convince some other drunk. They began working on a third alcoholic, and this practical cure for drunkenness was born. And this is what Dr. Bob had to say. Members of Alcoholics Anonymous begin the day with a prayer for strength and a short period of Bible reading. They find the basic messages they need in the Sermon on the Mount, in Corinthians, and the book of James. But that is not enough. For you cannot honestly accept what you read without also putting it into practice. And that means that you must help someone else. So there is a piece of our history that I wanted to pass on that appears to be original material. Next, I want to move into the beginner's classes that were taught in the early 1940s. And we're not talking about beginner's meetings. We're talking about beginner's classes. One part of Washington, D.C.'s early history that has been at least partially resolved during the last several years has been the source of the pamphlet titled Alcoholics Anonymous, An Interpretation of Our 12 Steps. We had this pamphlet and many, many different copies of it in our archives, but it took years to track down the source. In fact, Mitchell K. again turned out to be the gentleman with the source. He has the first printing of this pamphlet, and it's the only first printing I've ever seen, and it is in his collection. But it was reprinted all over the country. And it was even still being printed up until a couple years ago in Seattle, Washington, with the title Table Topics. And it was originally published there with a title Table Mate. So if you ever see these pamphlets in your travels, these are also the same basic format of the interpretation of our 12 steps. This pamphlet was used by a great many AAs to take the 12 steps in the shortest amount of time possible. Actually, the steps were taken in 4 one-hour classes. Earl H., the former archivist for Oklahoma and my sponsor, went through these classes beginning in 1954 when he came into the program. He enjoyed them so much he continued to attend them for the next 2 years. Jokingly, I asked Earl if he stayed in the beginner's classes so long because he was a slow learner. And he assured me that after the first time through, he started taking other people through. And after a couple times through, he started teaching the classes. And that's what helped keep him sober. The pamphlet's introduction contains the following. Meetings are held for the purpose of acquainting both old and new members with the 12 steps on which our program is based. So that the 12 steps may be covered in a minimum of time, they are divided into 4 classifications. One evening each week will be devoted to each of the 4 subdivisions. Thus, in 1 month, a new man can get the basis of our 12 suggested steps. Discussion number 1, the admission. Discussion number 2, the spiritual phase. Discussion number 3, the inventory and restitution. And discussion number 4, the active work. Now, this is, again, right out of this original pamphlet. In discussion number 2 on the spiritual phase of the program contained an interesting statement on several of the steps. In step 3, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. The author wrote the following. Religion is a word we do not use in AA. We refer to a member's relation to God as the spiritual. A religion is a form of worship, not the worship itself. If a man cannot believe in God, he can certainly believe in something greater than himself. If he cannot believe in a power greater than himself, he is a rather hopeless egotist. Again, they didn't mince words. Step 5, admit to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrong. There is nothing new in this step. There are many sound reasons for talking over our troubles out loud with others. Under this step, it is not even necessary to go to a priest or a minister. Any understanding human being, friend or stranger, will serve the purpose. The intent of this step is so plain and definite that it needs little explanation. The point is that we must do exactly what the 5th step says sooner or later. In step 6, we are ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Remember, it is our character we are working on, not the other fellows. Here is a good place to drop the critical attitude towards others, the superior attitude towards others. We must clean our mind of wrong thinking, petty jealousy, envy, self-pity, and remorse. Here is the place to drop resentments, one of the biggest hurdles the alcoholic has to get over. And in step 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. The meaning of this step is clear. Prayer. Humility. No man can tell another how to pray. Each one has or works out for himself his own method. Meditate, think clearly and cleanly, and ask God to direct our thoughts. Christ said, "Ask and ye shall receive." What method is simpler? Simply ask. Step 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for our knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 1. We pray each night, every night, a prayer of thanks. 2. We pray every morning, for help and guidance. 3. When we are lonely, confused, uncertain, we pray. And within discussion 2 was a statement that came directly from the Oxford group. And this is a quote. Choose for each day a quiet time to meditate on the program and your progress in it. So what Bill left out, they put in. In discussion number 3, They do discuss step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. The intent and purpose of the step is plain. All alcoholics have definite need for a good self-analysis, a sort of self-appraisal. The inventory must have four things: honest, searching, fearless, and moral. We will find that the root of our troubles lies in resentments, false pride, envy, jealousy, selfishness, and many other things. And as I said earlier, the pioneers took the newcomers through the steps as quickly as possible. They realized that lasting recovery and contented sobriety were contingent on working with others. And the sooner that they did that, the better. Clarence Snyder, the man who started AA in Cleveland, took people through the steps in a weekend. And he used to say, "You come to me on Friday night on step one, and when you leave here on Sunday morning, you'll be on steps 10, 11, and 12. And in our third edition of the Big Book, a story written by Earl Treat, the first man to get sober in Chicago, he wrote on page 292 that he took all the steps with Dr. Bob in 3 or 4 hours. So the step classes were quite important. The step classes were discussed within the early grapevines. Three articles, in fact. This is the third one. The first one came out in June 1945, and it was published in the grapevine from St. Louis. Here we go with another anonymity break. The Wilson Club, one of the four St. Louis AA groups, is now using a very satisfactory method for educating prospects and new members. It has done much to reduce the number of slippers among new members. In brief, it is somewhat as follows. Each new prospect is asked to attend 4 successive Thursday night meetings, each one of which is devoted to helping the new man to learn something about Alcoholics Anonymous, its founding, and the way it works. The new man is told something about the book and how this particular group functions. And then it goes into their 4 1-hour classes, which were slightly different from the 4 1-hour classes in this book, in this pamphlet. And I do have reprints of this pamphlet available, because this was the first one. But then what we find is each group is autonomous, and each group took these and modified them. The St. Louis group did. Rochester, their 4 1-hour classes is published in September 1945. And the title there is Rochester Prepares Novices for Group Participation. What I found interesting in Rochester, New York, is that you had to take the classes before you ever attended a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You attended your first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous having completed the steps. That way, when you attended a meeting and a newcomer came in, you were there to take them through the steps because you had already completed them. And actually, the way it was done, when the new man came in, you were assigned to him to take him to the classes. And that's how you took the classes over and over and over again. And that's how the new man got to do his fourth and fifth step. He already had somebody right there next to him that he could do his fifth step with. And that was in Rochester. And this is the one that's St. Paul that describes the 4 1-hour classes there, again, which were slightly different, each group being autonomous, than the one published in Washington, D.C. What was absolutely uncanny is I've been traveling all over the country tracking down this pamphlet and going from archival collection to archival collection and from archivist to archivist, which has led me to again, a lot of beautiful people who are dedicated to preserving our history. But it wasn't until I attended a meeting up in Phoenix. It wasn't even an AA meeting. It was a toast and roast for Stan W., who had just celebrated 50 years of sobriety. And so our home group, he's a member of our home group, the Golden Age group, and a lot of our home group members and members from other groups from all over the city, in fact, all over the state came to pay tribute to Stan. But while one of the old-timers was at the podium, he turned to the audience and just stopped and said, "Where are the beginner classes?" And one of the people in the back of the room said, "Pat, they're in the book." And Pat says, "No, I'm not talking about these psychobabble classes, that these psychobabble meetings that are being held today, where a bunch of newcomers are sitting down talking to a bunch of newcomers, none of which know what they're talking about, and trying to stay sober. I'm talking about those 4 one-hour classes that were taught behind the Arid Club in downtown Phoenix when I came into this program. And here I've been traveling all over the country looking for these classes, and they're in my hometown. And I never knew it. And I'd interviewed Pat. I've got him on tape for at least 5 hours, and he never brought him up before. He didn't even know that I was looking for them." Talk again about coincidence. The following week, there's a meeting that I attended halfway across the state. I had to drive 5 hours, almost as far as I had to drive to Sedona, to my first AA meeting. And in fact, it was on the way to Sedona because another member of AA in Arizona was celebrating their 43rd birthday. And I wanted to spend time with him. And this was an AA meeting. But before the meeting, where you're having breakfast together, everybody that had traveled these long distances, and a person, and I was talking about these 4 one-hour classes and how Pat had talked about the classes being taught in Phoenix. And one of the people at the table said, "I used to teach that class." I said, "What?" He said, "Oh, absolutely. 4 one-hour classes." And he said, "I may even have my notes." And then another lady at the table said, "I took those classes." And she said, "I came in 1972. And even in 1972, I went to an AA meeting, and at that meeting, after it was over, they told me that I had to go to the classes before I went back to another AA meeting." And her second meeting turned out to be her first class. And the gentleman that I talked to that had taught the classes, about 2 weeks later, found his notes squirreled away in a box and sent me down, not copies, he sent me down the originals. So these are the 4 one-hour classes. He says, beginner's class, Phoenix, outline for class number 1, outline for class number 2, outline for class number 3. So even in the 70s, these classes were being taught. Let me have a show of hands. How many people have either taken the classes or know of classes being taught in their town or in their groups? 2. And is that from classes still being taught today? Great. Okay. And what area? King City, north of Toronto, Canada. And for you, sir? In Massachusetts. Beginner's classes. Excellent. Excellent. So in the Boston area, they're still doing it. But look at all the hands that didn't go up. Isn't it amazing how much of our history has been lost? And we wonder why the recovery rate is less than 5% now when it was 75% back then. This is why it was 75% back then. Think about it. You walk into a room, they grab you and put you down in a class and teach you our program, teach you what's in our book. And then once you quote-unquote graduate, they assign a newcomer to you, and it's your obligation to take them through the steps or to at least sit with them in the class. And then after you've done that a couple times, then you teach the class. I mean, when do you have time to go out and get drunk? If you're plugged in and right in the middle of the recovery process, right from the first day you walk in. The classes were expanded upon. Let me tell you about this, the Back to Basics. Earl H., my sponsor, he does a 3.5-hour summary of the classes as a workshop. He couldn't remember anywhere in his travels where he'd actually seen anybody going through the steps in the 90s this way. And we were talking about it, and he says, "Wally, if you're so interested in these 401R classes, then start teaching them." And so I started to teach the class as I understood it right out of this book and with his guidance. And about the sixth time through, I was up in San Manuel, Arizona. First of all, in order to do this, it has to be within driving distance, and I have to, and it's a commitment for, at this group, it was Friday night for 4 Friday nights in a row to do this. And they made the commitment, and I made the commitment. And they wanted it taped for the rest of their group members that couldn't attend the classes. And I did it. And this is the tape that is available if anybody wants to hear a 90s rendition of exactly how the steps were taken. Now, I'm not talking about teaching the classes. We took every step in the rooms, of course, with the exception of step 5. At the end of the second session, I'd explained what I understood to be step 4 out of the book, and between that session and the next Friday, actually we gave them 2 weeks to spend time with their sponsor or spiritual advisor and actually take their fifth step. And then we came back and we picked it up with a summary of how the fifth step should be taken, again directly out of the book, and then went on and took the rest of the steps right there in the room. All 12 steps. It can be done. And I did see lives changed as a result of it. I saw it right in front of my eyes. These 401R classes were later expanded upon and became the basis of the Little Red Book, which was published starting in 1946. We had a discussion on this Little Red Book the break, or after the last session, yesterday afternoon, and some people were saying how they didn't get a lot out of the Little Red Book, and it never even dawned on me to ask, which Little Red Book are you talking about? And I want to ask, I can't remember who the people were that that were discussing this, that I was part of that discussion. Let me throw that out now. The Little Red Book, as published in 1946, is not the Little Red Book that's published today. This book was much more God-oriented. It was much more directive rather than suggestive. And it did come directly from a result of these 401R classes. What happened, again, as what happened to the 24-hour book, this book was offered to AA, and AA turned it down. And it subsequently was picked up by Hazleton. But I did want to let you know that Hazleton gutted it when they picked up the rights to it. The Little Red Book, this book is much larger than the Little Red Book that you see today, and it's square rather than rectangular. That's the way to identify one from the outside, and it'll have a copyright date between 1946 and 1952, though they did continue to print the old and the new one simultaneously up through the end of the 50s. But make sure, I do find this book to be helpful. This book, the original Little Red Book. And on the flap of the book, and the next one, there it is the statement that few books have a greater record for humble service than the Little Red Book, upon which so many members have cut their AA teeth. This book evolved from a series of notes prepared for 12-step talks to AA beginners. Direct reference to the classes. A manuscript drawn up from these notes was sent to Dr. Bob at the request of U.S. and Canadian members. He approved the manuscript, and the book was printed in 1946. Annual revisions have been made since that date. So this book was approved by Dr. Bob, not the one that you see today. And I ask that anybody that wants to relook at what's in the Little Red Book, please try to get your hands on an original and see if you can't see the amazing difference in terms of a God-based program versus what Hazleton did to it years later. Well, we have been going for almost an hour and a half. Let's see. I do want to, I'm going to do one more for this section, and then we'll finish up on, there's so much more on the 40s that I could relate to, and we'll pick it up after the break with the traditions and then our unsung heroes. And then we also want to talk about the challenge that Jim made to you last night in terms of taking a morning meditation and sharing with us later what God has guided you to say. But before we break, let me go ahead through the AA sponsorship pamphlet. Again, this is the only copy. This is another piece of our history that's lost. Don't know of any originals. I picked this one up again from Mitchell. God, talk about a source of information. And this is this is barely legible. Again, another piece of our history that that has been lost. It was printed and distributed in 1944 by the Cleveland Central Committee. Clarence Snyder, the person credited with starting the first AA group in Cleveland, was a secretary of the committee at the time that it was published, so he definitely had something to do with it. The preface of this pamphlet reads, "Each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is a potential sponsor of a new member and should clearly recognize the obligations and duties of such responsibility. In the following pages, we have outlined a suggested procedure which, when supplemented with a member's own experience, has proven to be successful. The personal gains of being a sponsor. No one reaps the full benefit from any fellowship he is connected with unless he wholeheartedly engages in its important activities. Any AA who has not experienced the joys and satisfaction of helping another alcoholic regain his place in life has not fully realized the complete benefits of this fellowship." And to the prospective members, "Most people have among their own friends and acquaintances someone who would benefit from our teachings. Others have names given to us by their church, by their doctor, by an employer, or by some other member who cannot make a direct contact." And there's a section on qualifying the new man or person. "Much time and effort can be saved by learning as much as possible. One, does the man really have a drinking problem? Two, does he know he has a drinking problem? Three, does he want to do something about it? Four, does he want help? If the man isn't an alcoholic, or if he is satisfied with his present plan of living, we should drop him from our list. Let him know where he can reach AA if he wants to contact us at a later date. Experience has shown that age, intelligence, education, background, or the amount of liquor drunk has little, if any, bearing on whether or not a person is an alcoholic." Then the pamphlet goes on to describe the suggested steps in presenting the AA program to a prospect. This is how to make the call. One, qualify as an alcoholic. In calling upon a new prospect, it has been found best to qualify oneself as an ordinary person who has found happiness, contentment, and peace of mind through AA. Two, tell your story. Many members have found it desirable to launch immediately into their personal drinking story as a means of getting the confidence and wholehearted cooperation of the prospect. Three, inspire confidence. Point out your series of unsuccessful efforts to control drinking. Their absolute fruitless results, and that yet you were able to stop drinking through the application of AA principles. This will encourage the prospect to look forward with confidence to sobriety in AA. Four, talk about plus values. Tell this prospect frankly that he cannot quickly understand all the benefits that are coming to him through AA. Tell him of the happiness, peace of mind, health, and in many cases, material benefits that are possible through understanding and application of the AA way of life. Five, show importance of reading the book. Explain the necessity of reading and rereading the AA book. Point out that this book gives a detailed description of the AA tools and the suggested methods of application of these tools to build a foundation of rehabilitation for living. This is a good time to emphasize the importance of the 12 steps and the four absolutes. 6. Qualities required for success in AA. Convey to the prospect that the objectives of AA are to provide the ways and means for an alcoholic to regain his normal place in life, i.e., return to the mainstream. Desire, patience, faith, study, and application are most important in determining each individual's plan of action and gaining full benefits of AA. And 7, introduce faith. Since the belief of a power greater than oneself is the heart of the AA plan, and since this idea is very often difficult for a new man, the sponsor should attempt to introduce the beginnings of an understanding of this all-important feature. Frequently, this can be done by the sponsor relating his own difficulty in gaining a spiritual understanding and the methods he used to overcome his difficulties. Listen to his story. While talking to the newcomer, take time to listen and study his reactions in order that you may present your information in a more effective manner. Let him talk too. Remember, easy does it. That was 8. 9, take to several meetings. To give the newcomer a broad and complete picture of AA, the sponsor should take him to several meetings within convenient distance of his home. Attending several meetings gives a new man a chance to select a group in which he will be most happy and comfortable. And it is extremely important to let the prospect make his own decision as to which group he will join. Impress upon him that he is always welcome at any meeting and can change his home group anytime he so wishes. 10. Explain AA to the family's prospect's family. A successful sponsor takes pains to and makes any required effort to make certain that those people closest and within the greatest interest in their prospect, a mother, a father, a wife, etc., are fully informed of AA, its principles, and of its objectives. These suggestions for sponsoring a new man in AA's teaching are by no means complete. They're intended only as a framework and general guide. Each individual case is different and should be treated as such. Before taking the responsibility of sponsorship, a member should make certain that he is able and prepared to give the time, effort, and thought such an obligation entails. And it says in the, as a closing, if you're going to be a sponsor, be a good one. And that's our early sponsorship pamphlet. Let's go ahead and take a 15-minute break, and we'll convene with the traditions and our unsung heroes. The final leg of the seminar, AA, the Greatest Spiritual Movement of the 20th Century. I'm going to start this section discussing the evolution of the traditions in the 1940s. And several traditions came about directly as a result of various incidences that were going on at the time. Raleigh Hemsley, not single-handedly, but he was one of the people that talked about the most in terms of the 11th and 12th traditions in terms of personal anonymity. In April of 1940, AA experienced its first major anonymity break, and this was Rollicking Raleigh. He was a baseball catcher for the Cleveland Indians who had just caught a no-hitter pitched by Bob Feller. For years, Raleigh had been called the bad boy of baseball. His Major League Baseball career began in Pittsburgh in 1928. Because of his antics, both on and off the field, he was traded several times. In the next 7 years, he also played for the Chicago Cubs, Cincinnati Reds, St. Louis Browns, and Cleveland Indians. Talk about taking some geographics, huh? He also got quite a reputation. He set fire to cars, raised hell on trains, and had, when drunk, caught a ball dropped from Cleveland's terminal tower. He actually caught it. This is how Raleigh's story was reported by the press as a result of a news conference he held to celebrate his one-year anniversary. Hemsley tells how he defeated Liquor by Frank Gibbons. And this is Chicago Byline, April 17th, 1940. The slide that's on the back is another one of the many newspaper articles. This one's called, I like this one too, A Home Run for Alcoholics Anonymous. Hemsley on wagon finally makes good as catcher. This was the other one. Hemsley tells how he defeated Liquor. Raleigh Hemsley, the Indian catcher who in 1 year has staged a personal reform which has amazed the sports world today, said he was sure he was through drinking forever and wanted it known so that he might help someone else. The one-time bad boy who pursued a career saturated with liquor for 13 years in the big leagues gave all the credit for his reform to an organization known as Alcoholics Anonymous. He said two Cleveland businessmen came to him just 1 year ago on his return to Cleveland from New York, where he had been suspended from the train by manager Oscar Vitt. The suspension was the result of an all-night carousal which started in Richmond, Virginia, and continued on the train to New York. These men, Hemsley related in a press conference, called by himself in the lobby of the Hotel Del Prado, talk about a major anonymity break, said, these men did me the biggest service I ever had in my life. After they talked to me, I went to Akron and entered a hospital for a few days. Obviously, Dr. Bob was responsible for his hospitalization. I went in for a rest and some heavy thinking instead of heavy drinking. They told me what was wrong with my thinking. I have not had any trouble since then. I could sit around in bars all night without wanting a drink. I'm telling all this because I'm sure I can help someone else who can't leave the bottle alone. After all, the secret of the thing is that you forget your own troubles and try to solve someone else's. Here we go again. How many times have we heard this over and over and over again? Going out and helping somebody else. Hemsley revealed that Alcoholics Anonymous is composed mostly entirely of people who at one time were drunkards. There are no dues to be paid. There is no formal religion in the non-sectarian group, but there is a spiritual side. I read the Bible some every day and spend a short time in the morning in meditation, the catcher revealed. Don't think this is a prohibition movement because it says in our book that we have no objection to people drinking who can handle it. We just try to help people who have what you might call a drinking disease, people who can't stop no matter how hard they try. Everyone associated with the ball club has noticed last season that Hemsley made new friends in every city in the league. These men, all apparently prosperous businessmen, met him on his arrival at the various towns. So here is the word coming out that Raleigh is coming to town, and the AAs were at the train to meet him and to help him along and ensure that he continued his sobriety. We hold meetings and compose and compare our problems, he said. As far as I know, there isn't any leader of the movement. There is a central committee in New York. There could be no doubt of his sincerity as he told his story today. I haven't had a drink in a year, so that proved the thing to myself. I've been meaning to tell this for some time, and I guess Feller's no-hit game yesterday put me in the right frame of mind for it. And that's Raleigh Hemsley and part of the evolution of the 10th and 11th traditions. I love this one. Water Wagon gets Hemsley by Alcoholics Anonymous. This was all over the country, these various press headlines. Next, I want to talk a little bit about tradition number 3 in terms of membership. This is a letter that was written on December 5th, 1941. This is from the Alcoholics Anonymous Los Angeles group. And I just want to read it and just let the chips fall where they may in terms of how Los Angeles conducted their early meetings. Dear Mrs. Lavoni, At a meeting of the Executive Committee of the Los Angeles Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, held December 4th, 1941,